VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Tuesday that Israel's forces will stay in a buffer zone on the Syrian border for the foreseeable future. AP correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Standing atop Mount Hermon, Netanyahu said Israeli troops will remain until another agreement is found to ensure the Jewish state's security. It was apparently the first time a sitting Israeli leader stepped foot that far into Syria. Israel's capture of the demilitarized area in Syrian territories drawing criticism that it's violated a 1974 ceasefire setting up the buffer zone. UN spokesman Stefan Dujarric says a deal is a deal.
Occupation is occupation, whether it lasts a week, a month, or a year. It remains occupation.
Sagar Magani, Washington.
Amid conflicting reports about Russia's future in Syria, Russian military assets are on the move in Latakia, the home province of fallen dictator Bashar al-Assad and his father. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports.
Jets and airplanes move off this Russian military base in the Latakia province of Syria. In the news and on the streets, there are conflicting reports about where they are going. Some say they are leaving Syria. Others say they are not. A nearby neighborhood still has shops with signs in Russian, catering to soldiers' needs. Some locals tell us they fear minority groups in Syria will be in danger without Russian protection after the fall of the Bashar al-Assad regime more than a week ago. Others say the Russians' move is a sign that the war is ending. Russia was a close ally of the Assad government, entering the Syrian civil war to defend the regime in 2015. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Latakia, Syria.
This is VOA News. A senior U.S. military official said on Tuesday that a couple hundred North Korean troops fighting alongside Russian forces against Ukraine had been killed or wounded in battle in the Kursk border region. The official, who spoke on condition of anonymity to provide a U.S. assessment of the war, didn't provide details on exactly how many had been killed. The official says the North Korean forces don't appear to be battle-hardened, which contributes to the number of casualties they've had. The man accused of killing an American healthcare executive was charged on Tuesday with murder as an act of terrorism. AP correspondent Haya Pandwani reports.
The defendant is charged with one count of murder in the first degree and two counts of murder in the second degree, including one count of murder in the second degree as an act of terrorism.
Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg at a news conference. Luigi Mangione was already charged with murder in the killing of Brian Thompson, but this terror allegation brought forward by Bragg is new.
This was a frightening, well-planned, targeted murder that was intended to cause shock and attention and intimidation.
Thompson, who was 50, was shot dead as he walked to a Manhattan hotel where Minnesota-based United Healthcare, the United States' biggest medical insurer, was holding an investor conference. I'm Haya Pandwani.
Residents of New Jersey and other eastern U.S. states have been saying for weeks they are seeing thousands of unidentified drones flying overhead. Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener reports.
The phenomenon has sparked conspiracy theories and demands from lawmakers and some state officials for investigations into what's soaring overhead on the East Coast. Since November, hundreds of people have shared photos and videos online. The majority of reported sightings have come from New Jersey. But people in Maryland, Virginia, Massachusetts, and New York have reported seeing them as well. The White House and the FBI have said the objects pose no threat. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said in a recent interview that there was no question New Jersey residents were seeing some drones, though he said at least some of the sightings were of manned aircraft. New York Governor Kathy Hochul called on Congress to enact stricter rules for drones, while New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy asked President Joe Biden for more resources to investigate the sightings. Some lawmakers have suggested that foreign countries could be dispatching the drones.
Reuters correspondent Jillian Kitchener. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 18, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Intense cyclone Chido kills at least 34 in Mozambique.
The chair of Mozambique's National Institute for Disaster Risk Management and Reduction said around 2.5 million people were affected by the cyclone.
The widow of the late Eswatini human rights and pro-democracy activist Dulani Maseko reacts to an award in his honor. Nigeria investigates the arrest of 800 people in a historic cybercrime raid. A Kenyan aid group is enabling refugees to access loans. Hundreds of Liberians took to the streets on Tuesday to demand the rule of law.
We don't want violence with the order of the day. That is why we assemble our people today, and President Jota Newman Bwaka and the police director were ordered to use lethal and non-lethal force against our people.
And Assad's Naya prison, the last stop in Syrian families' search for missing loved ones. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. At least 34 people were killed and 43 injured when Cyclone Chido smashed into three northern provinces of Mozambique on Sunday and Monday. The head of the country's disaster management agency says the numbers are preliminary as rescue teams search through rubble. Charles Maguiro reports from Mozambique's capital, Maputo.
After visiting the affected areas late on Monday, the chair of Mozambique's National Institute for Disaster Risk Management and Reduction, Louisa Meki, said around 2.5 million people were affected by the cyclone. We have 15 deaths, she said, 5,832 houses partially destroyed, 55 houses destroyed. This is the cumulative data so far, which is preliminary. Several districts in Cabo Delgado province, including the capital Pemba, were hit hard by the cyclone, and teams on the ground are reporting significant damage. Mekufi is a district in the province of Cabo Delgado where the cyclone made its landfall Sunday, and the destruction in the area was near total, with 100% of homes damaged and very few structures still standing. Kanjara Mad told VOA via WhatsApp that he lived through the cyclone, tearing apart his house. The wind took the sheets off during the night, and the house fell down when Monday morning came. We lived here with six people. The families are in the other house that I lent them in the other place, and they are currently trying to move our belongings there. Meteorologist Acacio Tembem from the National Weather Agency says parts of Mozambique are still getting hit by remnants of the storm. He says, we can also say that the province of Niassa will continue to experience this occurrence of rain, as well as the province of Cabo Delgado, where we had very strong winds and the destruction of infrastructure, mainly in the city of Pemba and the district of Mekufi. This system is practically a severe tropical storm. The system, which also hit Malawi and the island of Mayotte, is expected to dissipate near Zimbabwe by late Tuesday. Mozambique is considered one of the countries most severely affected by the global climate change. During the rainy season, which runs from October to April, it experiences cyclical floods and tropical cyclones. Experts say with a potential La Nina effect in southern Africa in early 2025, the frequency and intensity of heavy rains and tropical cyclones is expected to increase in the Indian Ocean, and floods are expected in areas currently affected by drought. Charles Manguiro for VOA News, Maputo, Mozambique.
Hundreds of Liberians took to the streets on Tuesday to demand what they called adherence to the rule of law. As Denise Nipson reports from Monrovia, the police used tear gas to disperse the crowd and arrested several protesters.
Yesterday, a group under the banner concerned citizens for the protection of the Constitution, democracy, and the rule of law declared a white Tuesday. They marched up to Capitol Hill, where the legislature, executive mansion, and temple of justice are situated, chanting slogans calling on the Bwaka administration to respect the laws of Liberia. The protesters who wore white were led by senior members and lawmakers from the former ruling coalition for democratic change of former President George Weah. John J. Bappe is the chairman of the group. He explains to VOA the purpose of the protest.
From the formation of the government, President Joseph Newman Bwaka and his Minister of Justice, they begin to remove 10 people from that position. That is the growth of population. And it didn't start there. Many Liberians, civil servants, been dismissed from their job because of their political affiliation. For the president to work out to even endorse situation at the house where people who believe to be the tyrannical majority taking decisions unto themselves, we believe all these things are violations.
Bappe was referring to the ruling from the Supreme Court. In August, the head of the civil service agency, Josiah Jokai, implied that some government employees were sacked for posting denigrating statements about the president on Facebook and other media. However, the EPS director, Sam Gay, told Frontpage Africa that the dismissals were aimed at improving professionalism within the service. Bappe, a former official of the government, explained that the police brutalized the peaceful protesters by firing live bullets and arresting some of them. VOA could not independently verify the shooting.
We don't want violence with the order of the day. That is why we assemble our people today, and President Joseph Newman Bwaka and the police director were ordered to use lethal and non-lethal force against our people. The way the police brutalized our citizens, most of them got injured, over 75 of our people were arrested. Some of them have been taken to court.
Police Inspector General Gregory Coleman refuted claims that live bullets were used on the protesters.
The police guided them, protected their rights, and the barricade was broken and all verbal command failed. That was when there was an escalation. And that escalation was only with the use of a non-lethal approach. At no point in time did we use live rounds. We even made vehicles available for you to go to the hospitals, mortuary. I also called all of our officers in different areas of command and checked all of the units. To date, we have not established anyone injured as a result of gunfire.
The former ruling Coalition for Democratic Change Party issued a statement condemning the police action and what it calls the violent suppression of peaceful assembly. For Daybreak Africa, I'm Denise Nissen in Monrovia, Liberia.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Martin, Washington. Today is Wednesday, December 18. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The widow of the late Eswatini human rights and pro-democracy activist Dulani Maseko says she has found courage knowing that though her husband was assassinated, what he fought for lives on. Maseko, the chair of the Monti Stakeholders Forum and a human rights lawyer, was killed in his home in January 2023. An Eswatini government spokesperson told VOA that the government had no role in Maseko's murder and has launched an investigation into his killing. This month, the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, presented to Tulani's widow, Tanele, the Secretary's Human Rights Defenders Award. Tanele tells me that the award is a bittersweet reflection on the work of her husband.
I think for me, it was bittersweet, but it was a moment of reflection as well to look into the work that Tulani has done for the people of Swaziland when it comes to fighting for democracy and just society in the kingdom. So it was painful because he's no longer here for this recognition and for him to appreciate and understand that other democracies, honest and free democracies, appreciate the work that he is doing. It was painful, but as well, you know, vindicating in a sense to say he might have died and might have been killed in the manner that he was killed, but he worked so hard for justice and democracy in the kingdom.
What has your life been like since the murder of your husband?
It has been a very difficult one in the sense that in terms of closure, we don't have closure as a family because there's been no investigation, there's been no updates. But number two, it's been difficult in the sense that he was the pillar within the Mass Democratic Movement of Swaziland. And, you know, the ideas and the vision that, so the Swaziland that he envisioned, you know, that idea is stalled, but not stalled in the sense that he's dead. It's stalled because, of course, the sense of fear and the sense of trying to regroup within the Mass Democratic Movement and finding focus. But we get courage to say they may have killed him, but what he stood for, what he fought for, we will continue those ideas to fight for as well. So we find courage in his words as well. When he was in prison, you know, he was always resolute to say, no matter the consequences on my body, but the ideals will never kill. So I think what he fought for and eventually what he was killed for, we will carry on with the fight of justice and democracy in Scotland.
What is the latest now that you know about the investigation into the murder of your husband? Because the government told us they were investigating.
As far as I know, there is nothing. In April, I was traveling home with my children, and I was stopped and detained by the security agency with the claim of that they've been looking for me and I've been evasive, to which I answered to say I've been the one calling them. And since then, in April this year, until now, they haven't come back because they said they wanted to question me, but they haven't come back. They haven't said anything. They haven't contacted my lawyer. So as far as I know, today as I'm speaking to you, there is nothing when it comes to the investigation of tonight.
The multi-democracy movement, what is the suspicion in terms of who might have been behind? Because we spoke to the government, and the government spokesperson repeatedly told me that the government had nothing to do with the killing of your husband.
So if they have nothing, why aren't they killing their name and getting the killer? Because the police took the three bullets that came out of my husband. Where is the ballistic report? What is delaying them if they're not involved? Because those bullets and the ballistic report would guide into the kind of weapon, and they would be able to investigate that. Why is it taking them more than 18 months to investigate if they're not involved? Because they are clear. I mean, they have no interest. So they just investigate and come out with a proper outcome. They haven't done that. So if they are not part and parcel, why is it taking them time to come out with the proper investigation and the proper information?
Madam, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to speak with you. And congratulations for the award.
Thank you very much.
Talide Maseko is the widow of the slain Eswatini pro-democracy and human rights activist Tulani Maseko. She was speaking with us from South Africa. Nigeria's anti-corruption agency, the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission, says it is investigating nearly 800 suspects arrested for alleged internet fraud during a massive raid last week in Lagos. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The Economic and Financial Crimes Commission says this is the greatest number of arrests it has ever made during a single raid. EFCC spokesman Wilson Uwujaren told VOA on Tuesday that the raid followed months of intelligence work and surveillance. The 792 suspects, including 193 foreigners, mostly Chinese, were nabbed December 10th in a seven-story building believed to be a Hustle Kingdom, a place where people are trained to carry out cyber crimes. Uwujaren said the foreigners were recruiting Nigerians there and training them on romance and investment scams targeting victims from North America and Europe.
For us, it's a testament to the fact that we're unrelenting in our effort to ensure that financial crimes, wherever they exist in the country, are checked. And then this current operation for us is an eye-opener because of the large number of foreigners involved, which is an indication that the perception of Nigerians as foreign people may not be true. We have a number of foreigners now coming to Nigeria to perpetrate frauds that are ascribed to Nigerians.
The EFCC recovered hundreds of computers, phones, and vehicles during the raid. The commission says it is collaborating with international partners to determine whether the suspects are linked to a broader network of internet fraud cells. Cybercrime is a growing problem in Nigeria. In April, a report by a coalition of researchers from the universities of Oxford and New South Wales ranked Nigeria fifth in the world for cybercrime activities, behind only Russia, Ukraine, China, and the United States. Lack of economic opportunities, inadequate cybersecurity awareness, and poor law enforcement are the reasons the trend is rising in Nigeria, according to cybersecurity analyst Abayomi Adeyanju.
There have been very good IT people, very good people with skill, and then these people graduate from universities, study, get certifications, and there are no jobs for them. And they would have to feel, I am one who would never ever say yes to crime or encourage crime. I'm saying these people, their skill can be used.
Adeyanju says beyond prosecuting offenders, Nigeria must create more opportunities in the tech sector to significantly curb cyber crimes.
If we can fix employment issues, so it's more like these people are not being gainfully used. The skill is just being there. And so if they have nothing to eat, the instinct of human first is survival. And so they definitely would want to survive. So I think the first thing first that should be done is that the economy should be fixed, and then more job and more employment opportunities should be created.
The EFCC says the suspects will be brought into court to face charges in the coming days. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
A Kenyan aid group is helping refugees improve their lives by providing affordable loans that will help finance their businesses. At least 13,000 refugees in exile have received loans. Victoria Amuga reports from Nairobi.
Adele Mubalama, a tailor at Kenya's Kakuma refugee camp, fled her home in the Democratic Republic of Congo in 2019. Mubalama says she abandoned her business selling clothing, and her efforts to get funds to begin a new trade in exile was futile. She says if you want to borrow money from the bank, they would ask you for statements and the Kenya Revenue Authority PIN number, which is very difficult for refugees to get. She says her dream came alive when she was granted a loan from Inkomoko, an organization that helps to empower micro and small business entrepreneurs, including refugees in Africa. She now makes bags and sells fabrics in Kakuma. She says they assessed me, then put me in training about running business. When I completed the training, she says they gave me the first loan of 30,000 Kenya shillings, which I used to start my business. At least 13,000 refugees in Kenya have received loans from Inkomoko, which means origin in Nyarwanda. But according to a 2024 World Bank report, despite the significant progress Kenya has made in developing a policy framework for refugees and host communities, refugees continue to face challenges in accessing services to improve their lives. Inkomoko founder Julian Oila says entrepreneurs can access up to $50,000 and pay back at an interest rate of 10% annually, lower than what most banks charge, and without collateral. Oila says that with the loans, many refugees see their skills and talents revived.
The system that was established to support refugees is completely outdated. Humanitarian funding is declining rapidly, while the number of displaced people is increasing. What we see is that the old way of working isn't working. It's when we bring private sector solutions into these refugee communities that we actually start to see economic development.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, UNHCR, reported that at the end of June 2024, 122.6 million people worldwide remained forcibly displaced due to disasters, persecution, conflicts, violence, and human rights violations, among others. This represents an increase of 5% or 5.3 million people compared to the end of 2023. International Organization of Migrants Senior Program Manager Pravina Gorong told VOA that climate-induced disasters are adding to the growing numbers of displaced individuals and are destroying livelihoods.
So when the people are on the move for safety and better livelihood opportunities, there is a risk of exploitation. And also without documentation, they cannot access any kind of services, including financial services. And also they can't access any type of assistance that is in existence.
Kenya hosts over 1 million international migrants, according to IOM, and nearly 800,000 registered refugees. Officials believe initiatives to help them access affordable financing will help improve their lives. Victoria Amunga, VOA News, Nairobi.
Sennaya prison in Syria, notorious for its history of torture and mass executions under the Assad regime, has become one of the last stops for families searching for traces of their missing loved ones. After Bashar al-Assad's departure, rebels freed thousands of inmates and uncovered a grim reality, corpses buried within its walls, leaving families with hope, but more often heartbreak. Marcus Houghton narrates this report from Ethel Bonnet, who visited the prison in Damascus.
Families look through Syria's notorious Sednaya prison for any clue on the fate of missing loved ones. A sound from the prison's secret tunnels sparks brief hope, only to fade minutes later. False alarm. Still, it seems no one wants to give up. Families wait outside for any trace of loved ones. Fatma from Aleppo is looking for her two sons. She came here as soon as Bashar al-Assad left the country.
He tore my heart. I have been wearing black for 13 years for my children. I want my children. United Nations, Westerners, Russia, France, Italy, Turkey. I want my children.
Others share the same anguish. Faisal al-Hussein from Homs searches for a son who vanished in 2012.
I've been here for days, sleeping in front of the prison, waiting to see him. They told me he was kept underground. I'm still waiting. My head hurts, my feet hurt. I can't walk anymore.
Inside Sednaya, the air is heavy and stale. Rescue teams work tirelessly in dark, crumbling corridors. Armed militants and desperate families move with only their phone lights to guide them. Turkish teams dig through concrete, hoping to uncover survivors or remains.
We found official records signed by the prison manager. It says there were 137,000 prisoners here, but much of the information has been destroyed. We don't have exact numbers.
A few kilometers away, the search continues at the Damascus Hospital. Photos of unrecognizable bodies hang on walls, waiting for families to identify them. A forensic doctor declines to give her name.
The prisoners, how can they do that? And as a people to the people, how they can do that? How they can do these criminal actions?
Sednaya prison north of Damascus remains a symbol of horror and repression. Today, its walls are painted with the colors of the revolutionary Syrian flag, a silent challenge to its brutal past. For the families waiting here, it's a reminder that even in the face of such darkness, love is stronger than fear. For Atel Bonnet in Damascus, Marcus Harden, VOA News.
And that's it for this Wednesday, December 18th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for coming aboard with us this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, saying, have a lovely day. The latest news about Africa and the world and its news summaries.
Africa in Brief airs every day at 400, 500 and 600 UTC. Give us 5 minutes of your time to be brought up to date. Africa in Brief, your trusted source for news.